This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to the Marvel Age podcast featuring the Sarcastic Four, episode 15, 1970, part 2.
Well, the characters represent a sort of a transcendent feeling that we all have inside us, that we could do better. We want to do better. We haven't time to do better. That we can be the people that we lionize.
Place to Be Nation Pop. Welcome once again to another edition of the Marvel Age podcast. I, of course, am your host, Nick Duke. Here to take you on another step down this year-by-year journey through the publishing history of the Marvel Universe. We have found ourselves all the way into part two of 1970. Of course, I do not travel this road alone. I travel it with the other members of the Sarcastic Four, beginning with, live on remote this time, Mr. Tim Capel. Tim, how are you doing this fine evening?
Yes, I'm okay. Speaking of traveling roads, or traveling the friendly skies, that is, I've been talking to other human beings what feels like all day long.
Oh, God.
About things that are not 1970 Marvel comics, and that is a tragedy. So I'm hoping we can rectify that and salvage these last few hours of the day.
Let's hope so. Let's hope so. Also joining us, of course, is the manager, Todd Weber. Todd, how are you tonight?
I am Bucky Barnes. I'm doing just fine. I'm not making towns like our friend Tim, but I'm having a great time here on spring break. So went out of town, not really. I've been staying at home, yelling at my children, and having a nice time without any work.
Well, without any employed work, yelling at children is work unto itself. Also, rounding out the Sarcastic Four this evening, Mr. Russell Sellers. Russell, how are you doing tonight?
I am not Bucky Barnes, and I have also not had to talk to pretty much anybody today. So it has been wonderful. But I'm here. But I'm glad to be here talking with you gents about the back half of 1970 Marvel Comics, because there's actually some pretty good stuff in this back half, despite what we're about to talk about.
Excellent foreshadowing on your part, Russell. And without further ado, let's just jump right into it and get cracking on our list for part two of 1970. Now, to cover a little bit of ground once again that you may have heard us cover before, we have shaken up the reading list a little bit. Tim has done us the service, the honor of kind of looking at the list we were using previously and kind of making some changes, because we had several times throughout this show had some complaints or some questions about why certain things were making the list at the exclusion of certain other things. So we decided to just let Tim take his own pass at it, and I think he's done an outstanding job thus far.
Cool.
So, with all that being said, here we go. And first up on our list for part two of 1970, the list, by the way, you can find at the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page, if you're so inclined.
Yes, I broke my Facebook embargo to post it there. That may be the only place I post on Facebook going forward, though.
Awesome. Well, to go ahead and get us kicked off, we're going to talk about some Captain Marvel in 1970. Now, we have not been kind to Captain Marvel, Marvel, in the past on these airwaves. We've kind of panned his adventures for the most part. And adding Rick Jones to the mix in what was, I think, 1969 or 1968 certainly didn't help matters at all. And certainly doesn't help in these two issues, because Rick Jones is back to being a whiny little bitch and talking about how terrible it is that he got everything he had ever hoped to have. Oh, man, how terrible. What a fate to suffer under, Rick. And he seeks out his original partner, the Hulk, in an effort to find some sort of way to break the bond between Rick Jones and Captain Marvel, or Mar-Vell. And why he does this, I don't know. Just so Rick Jones will have something to whine and bitch about. In any event, it leads to a largely uninteresting story, which is, you know, not that uncommon for Incredible Hulk-focused stories, especially in the 60s and 70s that we've read thus far, although a Hulk story we'll get to in a little bit later was at least somewhat palatable. So this Captain Marvel stuff, I'll be short and sweet, didn't like it. Didn't like it at all, did nothing for me. Anybody else got anything remotely positive to say about it? We'll start with you, Todd.
One of these mornings you may wake up dead. Find nothing but shadows living in your head. Gone forever the sun and the golden it spun. The show in her hair when she tossed it. No more bright yellow ball. And what's saddest of all, you won't even know that you lost it. This was not a fun read for me.
And you progressively lean into the Dylan impression as you went on? That's the way it felt, anyway.
So you cover your head with your foot, puts to bed. I think that's the voice that our friend Roy Thomas is going for here with his version of Rick Jones' stylings at a Greenwich Village coffee house in 1970. You know, we got protest songs all over the place, and Rick Jones is stuck in his own wussified Rick Jonesiness. Rick Jones is tired of being in the negative zone, I guess, when he and I don't mean the metaphorical negative zone, but the manager lives in all the time. But we're talking about the actual negative zone, the place where he goes, where Captain Marvel and he switch places, and vice versa. Captain Marvel can't be all that happy about it. But so they go and they try to, they think Bruce Banner is going to be able to save them, and no, he doesn't, and this is a whole lot of nothing, two issues worth, actually four if we continue the story, but we'll get to that in a second. This was not as good as some of the other stuff we've read, but not as bad as some of the Captain Marvel we've read, or maybe it is as bad as it. I haven't decided yet. I've only read it the one time.
I'm pretty down on it, honestly.
But we got to talk about the Rat Pack, I suppose.
Do we?
Yeah, these mercenaries, is that what they are?
It barely does. I mean, they show up for this little abrupt page-filling diversion, I guess, and then they're gone. So I don't know exactly what that was. I guess it gives Captain Marvel something to do for a couple pages. And so help me out here. What happens at the end? Like, he wastes too much time? Apparently there's a three-hour limit.
Since we last focused on Captain Marvel, they've introduced a new rule to this where he can only swap places with Mar-Vell in the negative zone for, at first they say 3 hours, but then it's revealed 3 hours worth of energy, because they say that he expended all of his energy in like 5 minutes and wound up turning back into Rick Jones against, like, accidentally at the end of the story. I didn't understand any of this was horse shit. And not to mention this 3 hour time limit that makes Rick Jones look like even more of a bitch. So like Mar-Vell's got to spend 21 hours a day in the damn negative zone, and you're gonna bitch about 3 hours? Dude, just go take a nap, shut up.
I mean, there could be something to this kind of odd couple dynamic between Rick and Mar-Vell. There isn't, but I'm just saying there could be potential in that. Like, these two people that have absolutely nothing in common. They don't know each other. They don't even particularly like each other, but they're effectively forced to just live as, like, one being and share the same space. And they just, I don't know, maybe if they leaned into that more, there would be something to work with here. We get a little bit of it in this issue, but not nearly enough to salvage it. And yeah, I mean, part of the problem with Mar-Vell is he doesn't really do anything, does he? He just, in terms of having powers, I guess he can fly, and
what are his powers at this point?
I don't know.
At one point, somebody is threatening him with a gun, and he's like, well, that would certainly do me in.
But he has some measure of super strength, I gather. He flies, and that seems to be it. And it's just, that really ain't enough to differentiate this character from so many others. And he sure doesn't have any kind of personality to set him apart either. I mean, it's just, it ain't working, guys. It ain't working.
I agree. Russell, yeah. I'm sure you're going to round out the unanimous wave of hatred for this.
Rick Jones is a miserable human being. Captain Mar-Vell is a miserable whatever the hell he is. Roy Thomas, clearly miserable writing this story. Stan Lee, probably miserable editing it. And Gil Kane was certainly miserable drawing it. So the misery just goes all the way around. I've had enough of this emo shit. Can we please just come back to it whenever he dies?
Sadly, I think we'll encounter him a little bit more, at least, because we have Kree Skrull War on the horizon, right?
Yeah, apologies in advance.
Which is also littered with a whole lot of Rick Jones. And it's really not hard to decide between Captain Mar-Vell and Rick Jones as to which one is worse. It's Rick by a strong measure. But they suck. There's nothing good here, though. I guess one little piece of good news that I can say finally is that all the bad things that I had to say about Gil Kane's art leading up to here, that's going to change a little bit later. So this is not good art, but I think I understand what happened now. He didn't like working on this book any more than we liked reading it.
Yeah, and for the record, I don't think that the art in Captain Mar-Vell is necessarily bad, as it is just utterly average. So that's kind of been my take on it. Anything else anybody wants to comment on Captain Mar-Vell before we move along? Go ahead.
You wanted to hear nothing.
No.
That's quite all right.
But I will hear your comment, good sir.
All I was going to add is simply that Gil Kane draws a pretty scrawny Captain Mar-Vell. I don't know if that's deliberate or he's trying to do something with the disparity of size between Mar-Vell and the Hulk, who is also part of this story. Well, part of 21, really. More so than 20. It's just...
If Hulk had caved in Rick Jones' head, he would become the biggest baby face in the Marvel Universe.
What a turn.
Yeah. What a turn that would have been. Yeah. I mean, he draws a pretty good Hulk. I don't like his Captain Mar-Vell, which is somewhat unfortunate given that is our protagonist here.
That's a good point. I wonder if maybe he was intentionally drawing him frailer so that he would not favor very well against Gil Kane's creation of Hal Jordan. Maybe that had something to do with it. Who knows? In any event, this story kind of leads us directly into the next entry on our list, which is Incredible Hulk 130 through 131. Captain Mar-Vell, luckily, nowhere to be found in the pages of this story. Rick Jones is nowhere to be found in the pages of this story. Just kind of, you know, the physical location where the Hulk is at the end of the Captain Mar-Vell tie-in is kind of where this picks up. He's in the same location dealing with some of the same characters and stuff, and it kind of tells its own independent story as Bruce Banner goes back to an old college colleague and enlists his help. And so he has this device that he uses on Bruce Banner, and the device is able to successfully, they think it's going to eliminate the Hulk, but what it does is it separates Bruce Banner and the Hulk into two separate and distinct beings. And man, is this the birth of one of the biggest like Hulk storytelling tropes that we've seen come back to over and over again over the years? Is this the first time that we get Hulk and Banner as two distinct beings?
Yep, it definitely is.
And it's not bad, I gotta say. Like, as far as Hulk stuff goes, most of it has sucked through these first almost 10 years of Mar-Vell that we've read. But
Nick
this
is correct.
Was okay. This is not bad. It's fine. I'll say it is readable enough, which is the best thing I can say about it, especially considering the state of most Hulk stuff thus far.
It certainly isn't as bad as what we've had before. That's true. But I guess the biggest compliment that I'm going to pay this Hulk story versus others is that it was also utterly forgettable. Because it was gone for me almost as soon as I finished reading it. So it doesn't really grab you, doesn't really do anything offensively bad either. It just, it exists, and like Nick already said, creates that trope of Hulk and Banner as two separate entities, which is something that a lot of writers and artists are going to go back to the well on many, many times coming up in the character's storied history. It does seem like they're still wanting to lean into the Hulk speak a little bit. Like we're getting closer and closer to that, but you know, baby stepping our way along. There's a couple of little things here and there that aren't too bad as far as like the action scenes go, but still, this is going to go down as just another kind of forgettable Hulk story to me.
Gotcha. One thing we learned in the pages of this is that Bruce Banner hates wearing shirts because he gets separated from the Hulk fairly early, and that motherfucker is shirtless for the next two issues entirely. He is not going to put a shirt on for anybody. Maybe it's because Betty Ross is finally reunited with him, and he's trying to show off the physique he's earned in their years apart. Or maybe he just, you know, was enjoying having some erect nipples. I don't know what Bruce's deal is without wearing the shirt. Tim, what's your take on this story, and more specifically, why didn't Bruce Banner wear a shirt?
Well, he's not wearing a shirt because he is wearing his trademark purple sweatpants. I mean, you talk about Betty and what she might be looking at, and you know, he's trying to impress her, and that would be one way to do it, in these shredded sweatpants, which, by the way, duplicated when they were split very conveniently. That was handy, and I like that touch a lot. So you've got Banner and Hulk running around in these torn purple sweatpants. The guy that he hooks up with to kind of oversee this experiment in this you know, whole separation, Raoul Stoddard. You know how it seems like some characters in comics are modeled after actors or, you know, other public figures?
Yeah.
I think the inverse is true here, and that the actor known as, I think his name is Anthony Held, who played Dr. Chilton in Silence of the Lambs.
Oh, yeah.
I think he was modeled after this this drawing, because that's all I could picture looking at this character, to the point of hearing him in that same kind of smarmy voice as well. So that was my take on this. And boy, we just really abandoned that whole Captain Marvel subplot, didn't we? That was great stuff. was like Rick James comes to him for help. That's what the plot of this whole thing is. That's why the Hulk is involved. And then, no, just kidding. We're not doing anything with Captain Marvel after that issue 21 of his own series. We're gonna stick with the focus on the Hulk here, and go in a whole different direction. So, not that I fault them for that. It's just kind of funny. I understand Captain Marvel the series is now on hiatus, so that may have had something to do with the shift in gears here.
I was going to ask Tim, did you get kind of Eraserhead vibes from Stoddard here? That's not a four head. That's not a five head. That's a six head. That is big enough to project a movie on.
I almost was thinking maybe we'd get like a leader reveal. Like they would do one of those goofy Silver Age plots, and he takes off the mask and it's revealing the leader. Green skin and all.
There's only so much a mask could hide for him, I guess. So yeah, if it was going to be the leader, I'd believe it.
Yeah, good stuff.
That is quite the noggin.
But no, I still think that I like the Hulk better as a supporting character in other people's books, excepting Captain Marvel.
I was about to say, be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, than as a
just
solo
not
character.
This,
right. Right. I mean, this story is fine, though. It's as Hulk stories go, as Hulk stories we've read on this show, it's is it the best in his own series? I kind of think so.
Yeah, it'd have to be. I don't. I say it's up there because I hesitate to say it's the best solo Hulk story we've read, just because I can't remember any other good ones though. Like I'm struggling to remember something else that I've enjoyed even as much as this, which I didn't enjoy all that much. I'm not. Right. I don't want it to sound like I loved this. It was just. It was all right.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course, you get to issue 131 introducing Jim Wilson, and there's some material in that that's pretty cringe, but I think I'll turn it back over to the panel at this point.
Yeah, I mean, it's just another example. Like, it's not especially well written, but it is yet another instance that we can point to and go, hey guys, comics didn't try to address political issues all of a sudden starting in like 2010. You know, this is something that Marvel in particular has been doing for decades now. Yeah. Todd, you haven't weighed in on Incredible Hulk 130 and 131 yet.
130 features the greatest forehead in comics, and that's about it. But yeah, they went to this.
Now what
well,
about the leader, though? The leader's got a pretty damn good forehead.
He does, but his name's not Raul.
Raul.
I mean, having the name Raul and that forehead, dude would be all over eHarmony, I'm telling you. So, you know, it was perfectly acceptable. Again, probably the least offensive of the Hulk comics we've read so far. I guess they're finding a groove, finding a story that works. Often we read comics to look up to the character, you know, to idealize the character and have this hero that you wish you could be, you know, the wish fulfillment. And then Hulk, you read and you realize, boy, it could always be worse for you, you know? There's nothing ever good happens to Banner. It's just this 50 years of tragedy of crap where he's just not allowed to be happy. And, you know, Batman's not allowed to be happy either, but he you kids want to be Batman. Nobody wants to be the Hulk. You just relate to it like this is my anger. This is the personification of me being angry. But I don't know. I'm just wondering, who are the people who read the Hulk?
Mm-hmm. We are,
but we're on assignment. But who's buying the Hulk every month?
Yeah, that is a good point that I hadn't really thought about. That
yeah, because how many books was Marvel up to at this point? Like early on, it was somewhat understandable because they were limited to by that deal with DC to how many titles they could have monthly. So I could understand if a hardcore Marvel fan was super into just what that company was doing and like their form of storytelling, they would just buy everything Marvel. Mm-hmm. Now they got to be up to like substantially more comics than they were in 1961, 1962, right?
They sure are. Yeah. They're just cranking material out, as we're going to see as the decade wears on. But yeah, I mean, it's at the same time, you know, they've kind of soft canceled X-Men. Daredevil is inexplicably somehow still being published. You've got the Hulk, which, as we've talked about, failed after six issues, came back as a regular feature in the flipbook anthology book, Tales to Astonish, and now seems to be chugging along healthily enough in his own solo series. But I don't know. It's like Todd was saying, he's not one of those aspirational types of superheroes, and it's just one of those things where there is an appeal, but it seems awfully limited to be sustained for as long as just this character has been in publication. But yeah, there are story problems in 131 too, as well, by the way. It's like you've constantly got all these characters showing up in the middle of the story and having to catch each other up on the comings and goings. And it's just like, God, this is a mind-numbing slog. I thought the conclusion with Iron Man at the end, pace kind of picked up, pretty exciting there, but felt a bit rushed at the same time. So
I would agree.
Roy is kind of, I don't know. Roy Thomas might be struggling on this series a bit.
And
yeah,
I mean, they're showing the Hulk having empathy and sympathy for the Jim Wilson character and mm-hmm. showing that Hulk can change, yes.
And Rick before that.
So, yeah, I don't know. I don't know what they're doing with the Hulk here. I think the Hulk works best when he's the direct opposite of Banner and not allowed to have these humanizing traits to me. Which Iron weird. Man is this? Is this Tony Stark or is this the guy that replaced him briefly in 1970?
I know what you're referring to. I believe this is still Stark. I feel like the story would have told us otherwise if it
wasn't.
Because the Stark, the him being replaced by, I think it was what, Jim March, was only like one issue. I mean, or if even that. I think there's a storyline where he gets mad and throws the suit away and somebody else gets it and he takes it back, like all in the course of maybe in the same issue, if not like an issue later. It is not long for the Earth.
A pair of issues I struck from the list.
That's all right. We understand.
Look, it's and Iron you Man. Left, if you really want to read.
You left the Captain Marvel on. And yet you left the Captain Marvel on. Son of a bitch.
Because it led into this story. I felt like we had to read this one.
And we did have a reversion to mostly the status quo at the end of 131, where they merge Hulk and Banner, but he doesn't turn back to Banner when he de-stresses. So that's setting up the next. Well, why is that? Uh-oh, maybe there's no more Banner. Dun-dun-dun. Yeah. I don't give a shit.
That is a perfect note to leave the Hulk behind on, I think, and move into something that I think we can all agree was much, much better. Probably the best thing we've read, or definitely the best thing we read, you know, on this particular reading list. And that, of course, is picking back up with Peter Parker in the pages of The Amazing Spider-Man. This time out, we read 88 through 91. And this is covering some pretty major hallmarks in Spider-Man lore. So the story kind of opens and you've got Doc Ock's arms that are being telepathically controlled from many miles away, which is something I just freaking love. I don't know why I love it so much, but the visual of it, the inherent goofiness of it, it's a cool little idea that I've always kind of dug. So anyway, Spider-Man has to fight the arms. Of course, he doesn't succeed. It leads to Doc Ock escaping from prison and just going on a bizarre rampage that involves, you know, political prisoners, ransom plots, faked deaths, and eventually just standard supervillain terrorizing the city stuff, all in the course of a couple of issues. But what winds up happening, of course, most notably, is the death of Captain Stacy. Gwen Stacy's father is killed as he pushes a small child out of the way of some rubble that has happened as a result of a brawl between Spider-Man and Doc Ock. And it's there that Peter gets another stamp on the old guilt card and something else to torture himself over as Gwen's dad passes away in front of him. So let's talk about these Doc Ock issues, 88, 89, and 90 first, and then we'll kind of separate 91 out a little bit, because I think that one, I am interested to see what you guys thought of that one, especially given its very relevant ties to the modern climate of comics. So 88 through 90, we'll start with you this time, Tim. Good shit, man. Good shit.
Real good shit. It's been a while since we covered a good Doc Ock Spidey dust up. So I was grateful to see that here. And at this point, it seems like Doc Ock is being pitched as Spidey's number one supervillain. I mean, this cover even touts him as such. And probably deservingly so. I mean, certainly we do have the Green Goblin in the mix here, Norman Osborn, but let's just say stay tuned for developments on that front. But here, it starts off a little bit goofy, like you said, the rampaging arms, which I love as well. And then Ock just so happening to hijack this plane with a foreign dignitary of
General Tsu.
Yes, General Tsu, thank you. A bit hokey there, but I kind of like the way that it just lends itself to this sense of escalating dread. Like, this wasn't supposed to happen, but Dr. Octopus is going to seize the advantage here, and it just becomes a very, very, like, tense situation for the characters involved in the story. I thought 89 and 90 had some really great kinetic action scenes. You also have Spidey having to lift a heavy thing in issue 89. So going back to that motif with the water tower that he is about to be crushed under, and that, more importantly, the onlookers below, who for some reason do not disperse witnessing this battle, he must protect, and he does. Kind of gets an ass whipping, and it's always nice to see see like a round two of one of these fights, right, where the hero gets his ass beat and, you know, has to go home and sleep it off, basically tend to his wounds and come back stronger than ever. He whips up this this kind of plot device to turn Doc Ock's arms against him and against themselves, which does work later to his chagrin, because this proves to be the instrument of Captain Stacy's death when the out of control arms send the rubble plummeting to crush poor Captain Stacy, who reveals with his dying words that he knew all along that Peter Parker was in fact Spider-Man. So Peter very quickly makes this about himself. this is another notch on his, I guess, his guilt trip that he's going to be wearing for, you know, basically for the entirety of his existence. But he kind of has a point. I mean, in a way, indirectly, this wouldn't have happened if he hadn't, I guess, come up with this specific plan of thwarting Doc Ock. But it's a little forced, but you can see where he's coming from, just because that's the type of character that he is. And of course, that leading into the next issue, having to console Gwen, who now blames Spider-Man more than ever. Yeah, good melodrama here, and good action scenes. You've got great art from both Romita and Gil Kane now on this series. So I like it. I like it a lot.
Awesome. Glad to hear that. Todd, what about your thoughts here on Amazing Spider-Man 88 through 90?
This was clearly the best thing we read this time, without question. I was confused because I didn't think that was Captain Stacy at the end dying because he didn't have his pipe in his mouth.
Or his cane.
Or his cane, either. Not as Gil Kane. So this was tremendous, actually. We've all heard about the death of Captain Stacy as a story arc, and now we got to read it. It's been kind of cool knowing what to look for, because the gimmick is that he was the one guy who had figured out Spider-Man's identity, and he kept it a secret. And apparently he's a well-liked by the people chief of police. You know, he's not, and we'll talk more about that in 92. But, you know, there's a little bit of everything in this, but I really appreciated the kinetic fight scenes and action storytelling that Kane does with both the disembodied arms and then just the classic Doc Ock Spider-Man matchup. This was really fun read, kind of easy reading going through it, not too weighed down by stuff you didn't care about. The plot keeps moving throughout, and, you know, it's kind of a revelation to see Gil Kane with an inker that gives a shit, or at least Romita is doing his best to keep the continuity of the story when he's inking Gil Kane. So it still feels like a Romita book, but with maybe, you know, more dynamic action or unusual bending things. You know, we don't see the Gil Kane ribs that we're used to, but it's a thing, you know, he draws ribs a certain way. And
what is the reasoning for Gil Kane here instead of Romita? Do we know that?
We don't know. He's on inks, which is interesting. So maybe Romita is kind of the guy that I always felt like he was kind of the principal or the vice principal of among the artists. You know, he was the guy that kind of oversaw the bullpen, and so maybe it's just his responsibility to say, well, we know what's happening with a big-time artist leaving the company very soon. Let's bring some more of these guys onto these flagship books and see if they can handle it. But just to ensure that the continuity is there, I'll do the inking. There's another guy who did some inking here that I forget the name. Van, I think it was on the 88, the issue, first issue. inking Romita, and it's actually not as strong visually as the Kane Romita team. But yeah, classic Spider-Man, and I'm glad to have finally read this story, and it's everything I expected. It was clearly the cream of the crop this week for me.
Gotcha. This time around. Russell, I know you're rip-roaring to weigh in on some Spider-Man, given that he is your favorite Marvel character. Tell us about how you felt about 88 through 90.
Favorite comics character. These were a revelation to me. And not so much in the storytelling as you've already talked about, because there's some just like seriously comics goofiness and weirdness going on here with the Doc Ock stuff, and just so happening to wind up on an airfield where there are political prisoners involved, and it's there's some oddity to it, but you just can't deny the power of Gil Kane's art. And as I was reading this, I was just taken aback at how great these issues look. Don't get me wrong, I love John Romita, love what he brought to the book, and of course Ditko before him, but Gil Kane in just the span of these issues has taken Spider-Man to a whole new level. This book is just gorgeous to look at, and they fill in some of the space with the fight scenes and everything. They fill those in with dialogue describing what's happening. But Gil Kane is such a dynamic artist that you can completely ignore what's coming out of the character's mouths and just watch how he flows the art, and you get it. You don't really need it. I mean, if Peter drops in a nice little one-liner or something, that's fun, but man, the art is driving this book, and it is driving it in a big, bad way. Really liked the stuff that they did with Captain Stacy. It really seemed like they upped his profile considerably just in these last few issues, because I guess they knew he was about to die. It would have hit harder with me if I had spent more time in all of the issues leading up to this, but still in his final moments when he reveals to Peter that he's known for some time that he was Spider-Man, that is a really powerful scene, and it's drawn wonderfully by Kane. So these issues are, as everyone has already said, this is top-notch stuff. This is good by modern comic standards. So timeless is how I think I could describe it best. This is must read. If you've ever been a Spider-Man fan in your life, these are some issues you need to pull up right now and read them.
Absolutely.
And it's not just Peter blaming himself for someone else's death. It's Peter losing another quasi-father figure, too.
Right.
When you look at, just kind of what Captain Stacy represented to him. I mean, this was someone he looked up to as Peter Parker, and certainly respected as Spider-Man as well, who has now just been taken from him. And it's great to read a story that really does live up to its reputation.
Absolutely. We kind of didn't talk about 91, and part of my reasoning was, one, because I think it kind of needed to be addressed on its own, given, again, its parallels to the modern day culture, but also because, Tim, correct me if I'm wrong, I think you probably only put 91 on here instead of the rest. This kicks off a new story, but the rest of the story doesn't really play out in 1970, so we kind of get the first taste of where Spider-Man's going to be going from here, right?
Correct. I thought about throwing 92 on here as well, just to finish out the story, but that was published in 71. We already kind of had enough Spider-Man to cover here, so I just pushed it into the next year, which is fine. We will finish the story. But this first half, we're basically following Sam Bullitt, who is this politician trying to take advantage of the absence, the void that has been filled by Captain Stacy's death. And they remark about how he was, had a fairly liberal attitude towards law and order. This guy is running on a really conservative ticket. Various characters call him a fascist at various points. Peter himself, when confronted, calls him a pious hypocrite. And, I mean, this is like, this is queer rage Stan Lee in a way that we've never really seen him with his claws out. I mean, it, certainly Stan has done, he's dipped his toes into some political-esque writing before and political themes, I guess you could say. But a lot of his earlier work struck me as doing a little bit of, paying a little bit of lip service to both sides, you could say. Like, he would, he wouldn't fully commit and say one way or another how he necessarily felt about something. He would kind of couch it in more nuance than you would expect in, you know, Silver Age comics, which is good. But here, it's like he is putting his foot down. And I think that's just a product of, he knows who his audience is now. He's mm-hmm. he's done this, you know, this college speaking tour. He's done all these lectures. He's been getting feedback and knows what people want to see in this book and who's reading his output, and pretty much writing to them and saying, you know what, my sympathies are really with my readership. And I will just add that there are points in this story where it almost feels like Stan Lee is writing a Batman comic. Just the way that Spider-Man is characterized and just the overall tone. It's quite a departure, and I liked it a lot. I'm looking forward to seeing how this wraps up. This is not a story I was familiar with at all coming into this.
This is...
Am I the only one who read Bullitt as Donald Trump?
No, it's Richard Nixon.
Not at all.
Yeah, I understand.
Well,
I understand it was Richard Nixon, but like reading it in 2019, it's hard to... I wasn't alive for Nixon like you were, Todd.
Well, we're going to see actual Richard Nixon very soon. But visually and the way he's patterned is, I mean, again, pious hypocrite, all this stuff. That you know is going through Stan Lee's head as he's writing it.
I did not read him as Donald Trump just simply because the vocabulary that Mr. Bullitt uses is somewhat different and more broad and diverse than, say, our current president. But that's just me. The opinions expressed by Todd Weber do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Place to Be Nation, nor Place to Be Nation Pop, nor our corporate forebears.
Now who's both sidesing it? Yeah. No, I get what you're saying. He is certainly, to say nothing else, a bit more erudite than our current president, as Richard Nixon was.
Indeed.
Yeah. This is another one of those example comics that anyone who tries in the modern era to say that comics didn't get political back in the back in their day of reading, clearly they got some selective memory going on, because as Tim pointed out, Stan really made no bones about how he felt about things in this issue. He put it right out there for you, and this is some powerful stuff. And looking at it, you know, reflected, all right, or looking at it in comparison to the current political climate we're in, this is a still relevant and poignant issue, one that kind of, you know, really hit big with me. This was probably my favorite issue of all the stuff we read. I thought this was brilliantly written, and once again, more Gil Kane art, and the guy is just at the top of his game. So you can't say anything bad about these issues. They're right on. And again, another one that is equally great by modern standards.
Absolutely. Todd, anything else you wanted to comment on about 91 before we move forward?
Is Spider-Man projecting an image of him on the walls, or is that just the artist saying liberally that Spider-Man is chasing them? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
He's got a little thing on his belt that reflects that emblem, or it shines that emblem. It's like their take on a bat signal, I guess.
Yeah.
But he controls it.
That's why I was thinking this is a Batman comic, because of those scenes right there.
The Spidey signal, as seen in what was it, the post credit scene to Civil War?
Yes.
Something like that. Trying to remember? Yeah.
Yep.
So there you are. All right. Well, with all that being said, I think, guys, we're going to take a break. We've reached the midway point of our reading list. Stick with us through the break. When we come back, we'll be talking some Fantastic Four, some Captain America, some Avengers, and, of course, you can't forget about the wonderful Place to Be Nation live read. Stick with us through the break. We'll be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Soho, where you drink champagne and it tastes like Coca-Cola. C-O-L-A, Cola. She walked up to me and she asked me to dance.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to the Marvel Age podcast. We hope you enjoyed that break. And here we are just to kick off the second half by talking a little bit more about what you can find across both of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Starting with the Place to Be Nation pop, take it away, Tim.
Okay, I sure will. Russell, you and Sam, yeah, evidently you dished about the classic Empire Records, and that was on a new 90s to nothing. Anything you'd like to add on that?
It's 90 to nothing. We're going to have to get that fixed one day. And, and it's certainly a divisive topic between Sam and I, and given some of the feedback we've already gotten about it, clearly it's a divisive topic amongst ours as well. So
I'm with you, though. I'm Team Russell on this one, man.
There we go. I'm glad somebody is, because I've certainly been on the losing end of this one. But you know what? I think some folks need to just go watch that movie again with modern eyes.
Okay, well, speaking of you sat down, yes, again, we're sticking with you.
Jesus.
You were Ben Morris's star student for the first half of the 1970 discussion on Marvel Age Masterclass. So the spinoff reaction show to this podcast you're listening to right now, reacting to our previous episode. And I thought that was a very, very good, awesome, excellent listen. Lots of good X-Men stuff in there that I had some thoughts on too. So do check that out. On news of Tim Capel, on the Tim Capel front, I was joined by Jenny, my regular co-host of Talkin' Pop, where we welcomed JT Rosero to relive the magic of WrestleMania weekend that went down in New York City. New Jersey City, in fact, talking about the mania of WrestleMania more so than the wrestling. That was on Talkin' Pop, which you can find on this very same podcast feed. Todd Weber, you and I took a look at Uncanny X-Men issue 136. That was the penultimate chapter of the Dark Phoenix saga on your show, Conversation Comics. Did you enjoy that one?
Oh, man. One of my favorite things to do is talk Byrne Claremont X-Men with my good friend Tim Capel. And, it was a fun reread and a fun show to do, and I hope you enjoy it.
Yeah, kind of cranking those out with more frequency. We're going to actually endeavor to finish out the Byrne Claremont run of Uncanny X-Men before we reach it on Marvel Age. I think we can do it, Todd. Now, you also joined Andy Atherton to talk Swingers, another great 90s movie, on his show, Laugh-In Theater. So how did that work? Was that a live watch and commentary, I take it?
Yes, it was. And it was a lot of me going, oh, man, I really sucked as a 24-year-old person. I was a terrible human being. I wasn't
getting
lots money.
Of, lots of X stories?
We got a few, or we got one
product
one
story,
long
okay.
one, yeah.
Drink.
Oh, wow.
So if you're playing the top four drinking game.
Always. That's still on my list. I got to listen to that. We're not done with you quite yet, though, because on your other show, Binge Please, you welcomed JT Rosero to talk about the Netflix Marvel Universe shows, specifically Daredevil Season 1. Thought you did a really great job corralling JT,
yes.
You know, as he is wont to wander off topic. But I mean, that's easy to do with this interconnected universe of telefilms on Netflix. So great episode there, and
Thank you. Good job
on your part as host. What else have we got? We've got some sports shows. We have Andrew and Adam delivering an in-depth playoff preview on a dual offering of the NBA Team podcast, excellent basketball podcast, a topic that I couldn't tell you anything about, but I know it's a great show. We also had the Cowboy and D'Amato back in the saddle with a new This Week in Sports. They caught us up on everything happening, I guess, in the world of sports since the Super Bowl. I gather that's a lot of sports. So if that's your bag, check them out. Certainly, I would be remiss and neglecting the hard-traveling fanboys. That is you, Nick Duke, and Greg Phillips. You guys reviewed Shazam on this week's most recent installment of the hard-traveling fanboys. Is it Shazam month, all month, celebrating?
It is Shazam month, and actually, since we just recorded one shortly before this recording, probably by the time you hear this, the most recent episode will actually be covering Jerry Ordway's 1994 graphic novel, The Power of Shazam.
Awesome.
Looking forward to that one.
Talking about a Captain Marvel we might enjoy a little bit more than the one we've been covering here.
Yes. There's no doubt about that.
All right. There's a new contest that's being held, too, over on Looking Forward, Looking Back. I'm actually going to be on that show.
Me, too.
Whenever it airs. Yeah. Oh, yeah, Tim, you and I are going to be doing this together, along with host Andy Atherton.
A bunch of people, yeah.
Yeah, and a ton of other folks from the Place to Be Nation crew are going to be joining in on that one, too. But everyone can get involved on this because they're doing a summer movie wager that's based on how well participants think they can predict the summer movie releases and how well they're going to do at the domestic box office. So what you do is you look at the list of movies that are eligible in this. In this case, it's movies that come out anywhere between April 26th through September 2nd, and you create a top 10 list of which movie you think is going to make the most at the U.S. box office, the domestic box office, and then you put them all in order, 1 through 10. And as a little bonus, you can pick like three wild cards that you think might also wind up doing surprisingly well. And as a bit of fun, pick which movie you think is going to bomb the hardest this summer at the box office. If Hellboy were eligible, I think we could probably go ahead and call this one now. But it missed getting in there, as did Shazam, unfortunately. But
Angry Birds 2, though, on the list.
Yep, Angry Birds 2 is definitely on that list, as are a couple of other films. But you can send your picks by Monday, April 22nd. That is the firm deadline. you need to send those to lflbpop@gmail.com. That stands for looking forward, looking back, pop@gmail.com. The winner of the contest gets to be on a future episode of Laugh In Theater, which Todd was just on recently to talk about Swingers. And you'll get to pick the comedy movie of your choice to watch and talk about with host Andy. So get those picks in. I've already got mine in. I feel pretty confident in them, but I think I would be surprised if everybody didn't have the exact same number one.
Yeah.
Dora.
Yep. How did you know?
Still can't
Detective Pikachu.
That's the one.
That's going to make money.
Yeah,
that's stupid. That's going to make money.
People are going to overlook it, but it's going to make some money.
Hell, I couldn't care less about a Pokemon movie at this point, and I'm probably going to watch that just because the trailers look good. So there you go.
Precisely. Same. I think it's in my top 10. It's somewhere in my top 10. I'm not going to say where.
There you go. Meanwhile, over on the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, in the premiere episode of Making Towns with Friends, my God, the With Friends franchise is expanding. Steve and Rich explore what could have been if a Money in the Bank match had occurred at every WrestleMania since Inception, the wonderful Chris Nolan movie back in 2012.
That sounds like What If.
It does sound like What If. Hmm. And it may have even been an idea that was given to the fine folks over at What If Wrestling that they were planning on doing next month. But that's neither here nor there.
Wow.
Meanwhile, JT and Scott were joined by Todd Weber for episode number 517 of the Place to Be podcast. And they broke down the March of 1989 MSG house show. Todd, how was that?
You know, it was quite the honor to be on the mothership and got to see a great Hulk Hogan and Big Boss Man steel cage match from Madison Square Garden where the Boss Man, Fat Boss Man, bled like a stuck pig. It was wonderful.
How many stores?
That match got 4.5 stores.
Oh, my God. That's high praise, sir. High praise. And speaking of stores, JT and Chad returned with a new Wrestling Warzone as they finish off 1995 with a discussion about WCW Starrcade.
Kind of a decent show, that 95 Starrcade. I'll just put out there.
Is that the sneaky New Japan one?
Yeah, kind of sneaky good. Yeah. I don't really care too much about the New Japan gimmick, but sneaky fun show.
But the matches are good, yeah. I get you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, once you've subscribed to our feeds on iTunes or Stitcher or what have you, check out our social media pages such as Facebook, like Place to Be Nation on Facebook, Place to Be Nation Comics on Facebook. Follow Place to Be Nation Comics, PTBN Comics on Twitter. We've got lots. We've even got an Instagram page. Now go to GeoCities Bigelow34.proboards.com. for information on joining our GWWE PPV and TV match ever. So if that's just a matter of you putting your 100 favorite WWE, WWF matches in an order and it's compared against others. So this is our stretch project for this year. Check it out. Get in the conversation, create a profile on the pro boards, the state-of-the-art pro boards, and start researching your lists. Be sure to check out placetobenation.com as things are getting back up and running there. We've got our weekly walk around the World Wide Web every Wednesday, published by Glenn Butler. And we've got other written content coming up. We're picking up every day a little bit better. And I have to say, the website's never looked more fresh, especially on mobile. I really like the way it looks, even if updating it is not as easy as it used to be. Okay, yes, Tim, you were saying.
Just saying, do not submit the entirety of WrestleMania 2 for the GWWE pay-per-view and TV greatest match ever project. You will get a talking to.
Sir, if you want to talk to Glenn Butler about his list, you can contact him directly, Tim.
I am told Glenn Butler was not responsible for that.
It was not. It was somebody that Arnold Schwarzenegger would say, Bennett!
Oh, God, don't even get me started. Anyway, let's move on. Let's move on, ladies and gentlemen. Get back to what you're here for, presumably, which is 1970 in Marvel Comics. And let's start with the second half with the first family of Marvel, the Fantastic Four. And here in issues 102 through 104, we kind of get a little Magneto and Namor story where Namor finds Magneto washed up on the shores of this island. I think it's supposed to be Genosha, right? After the events
of some X-Men story. No, we're a few decades away from Genosha.
What are we? Savage Land.
Well, on the outskirts of the Savage Land, I gather. Okay. It is some nondescript island, but we get a great scene of Namor swinging some pterodactyls and throwing them while screaming Imperius Rex. So that's fun.
Savage Land then. My mistake. But anyway, you know, the story itself is a fine story that kind of involves Magneto pulling the wool over Namor's eyes, and then eventually the Fantastic Four and Namor having to team up to take Magneto down. But really, it's notable because issue 102 marks the final issue of Jack Kirby on Fantastic Four, the final, for now anyway, Stan Lee and Jack Kirby issue. So this story, nothing great, honestly, but I liked it, and I liked it, you know, fairly well overall, and it's undoubtedly historically significant and a great opportunity for us to kind of look back on the Jack Kirby and Stan run that started this podcast. So big ups to those guys, 102 issues, still an incredible accomplishment and responsible for the foundation of the Marvel Universe as we know it. So Tim, take it away.
You know, I kind of dug this. Maybe I'm a Magneto, Mark. Maybe that's...
Oh, you are, but that's okay.
Yeah, I understand. That's okay. Hashtag Magneto was right. No, this is... we do get the last Kirby issue. He kind of goes out with little fanfare, although he will be back in somewhat reduced capacity on one more issue of FF that we will cover later. That may be somewhat interesting for other reasons. But anyway, yeah, so we get that last Kirby issue, 102, and then without skipping a beat, John Romita, I almost called him Junior, John Romita Sr. comes on board. Maybe he was pulled off of ASM to do this kind of last minute. But in any case, does a pretty commendable job keeping that story moving. And the story, for what it is kind of feels like a diet version of that first FF annual, right? With the Atlantean invasion of the surface world that was so very epic and that we heaped praise on in our early days of this podcast. Hell, we're still in our early days of this podcast. But in any case, we've got sort of a different spin on that, as you said, Nick, because Magneto is pulling the strings here. And maybe I'm just in that mode of reading Stan Lee as a more political writer here, but I mean, we've talked about how he's not exactly the most subtle author in the world, but I think he's pretty good about not beating you over the head with the themes he wants to explore, at least at his best. And I think what he's talking about with this story is just kind of the perils of nuclear proliferation, right? Where you've got on one side Namor and the Atlanteans who are poised to attack, and you know, the U.S. is questioning, do we strike first? We get that extended Richard Nixon cameo who doesn't have as much of the phonetic accent as I would like, but be that as it may. But yeah, he's just sort of pointing out how the smallest mistake on either side of this equation comes at so high a cost. Is it really worth it? I just thought the story did a great job of exploring those ramifications. So, yeah, not the best FF we've read, but still a pretty, pretty solid installment of this series.
Todd, your thoughts on this Fantastic Four?
This was not necessarily my jam.
Right.
I felt, especially the last Kirby issue, felt kind of out of step with some of the things we'd been reading in, say, the X-Men. You know, Magneto especially took a big step back, not just visually, but I mean character-wise. He was kind of portrayed one-dimensionally here after the very interesting take by Roy Thomas and Neil Adams, or we read in 1969. The art on 102 with Kirby is as Kirby-ish as ever, and you do get a classic thing is doing something wacky at the beginning. In this case, he's getting medicine shoveled down his throat, his gullet, by Crystal, and being just, you know, pure distilled Ben Grimm, and it's classic, and it's great that we got one last glimpse at that as drawn by Kirby. There were some great one-page panels or splash pages in the middle of there. I don't want to call it a splash page, but you know what I mean, pin-up type pages with Magneto and Namor, and you know, talking about the art was good, but this story to me kind of, I don't know, it dragged on in a ways that I just didn't enjoy it like I thought I was going to enjoy it. It felt a little old school for me. And we're in 1970, and it's still feeling just kind of like this was a 1965, 1966 Fantastic Four comic. Although we did get Sue Richards, who does very little other than getting caught and held hostage in this story. We do get her taking Franklin Richards to his babysitter, Agatha Harkness, who could be related to Aunt May. Yes.
I got, looked very well, not so much look, but kind of a Ruth Gordon from Rosemary's Baby vibe from her.
He looks like his father. His father. His father is Satan. Hail Satan. Sorry.
He triggered me with Rosemary's Baby.
That's one of my favorite things. That's a movie that gets me. Sorry.
I love that movie.
Maybe I'm going to start projecting that onto her instead.
Please do.
Romita does his best to kind of keep the visual continuity of Jack Kirby, but you know, it goes into Romita-isms, and that's not a bad thing. You know, it looks consistent. Sue doesn't do a whole lot, but Crystal does. She uses her elemental powers. Her non-specific elemental powers all throughout these. And I'm trying to think how it wraps up. It was just weird that Kirby went out without any fanfare, not with a bang, but with a whimper. And it wasn't really a whimper. It was still, you know, kind of a typical FF story here. But there was no mention of it saying, we're saying goodbye to the king after this literally unprecedented achievement. And it took many, many years, you know, Bendis and Bagley to eclipse the Kirby Lee team, if I'm recalling correctly. I mean, as far as on a monthly type comic.
Mm-hmm.
And Kirby didn't even get to draw the last cover. So I'm going to guess that he had drawn Fantastic Four out to 102 and then just kind of left, or he was all caught up and moved on to DC at this point, because Romita actually draws the cover of the last Kirby issue, which kind of felt weird to me. So, yeah, I mean, it's not bad. It's just not my favorite FF at this time. At this time, I think I'm looking for a little bit of a change, a little bit of an update to the world's greatest comic magazine.
I guess I just sort of like what a conniving shit Silver Age Magneto is. I mean, he's pulling the strings here. We saw earlier how he manipulated Wanda and Pietro in the pages of Avengers. All the stuff that we covered recently in X-Men, duping Angel in the Savage Land. So I don't know. I just kind of, not that it's my definitive version of Magneto, I just sort of like the through line there, I guess, of that characterization. And here he's just serving that role very well, and Stan's sort of cautionary tale that is just saying, you know, be wary of bad actors here on either side. You know, again, we're getting into some both sides-isms, but I like the way he was used in this story, sort of out of his element, no longer up against the X-Men, but kind of still holding his own here. And I thought impressive fashion. So this one a little bit more divisive.
Russell, your thoughts on FF 102 through 104?
Todd really did cover most of my thoughts on this. As I was reading it, I was like, you know, this is really setting my mind back to a much better take on this story over at the distinguished competition called Throne of Atlantis. And that may have taken some elements from this, like some of the ideas are there. But as Tim has also alluded to, this felt like a real step back for Magneto, for the Magneto that we had kind of come to know in some of the more recent issues of X-Men that we read. He seemed, I don't know, much more developed, much smarter, much better at planning things out. And here he just comes off as kind of mustache twirling to me. I do like the continued evolution of Namor. Like he's certainly not by a straight up villain by any means anymore. He is very much kind of an ambiguous type character. I really appreciate that, and it was cool, you know, seeing Kirby and Stan get this many issues in a row. That was really neat. But as far as this story goes, I feel like Todd called it right. This goes on forever. You could have done this in like maybe two issues, I think. You didn't have to draw it out as far as they did. And really, lastly, Reed Richards, still awful. So that's I gotta keep up with the gimmick, but I mean, there's just, it almost feels like this is a bit of marking time, honestly. Like we have something that looks big and epic in scale, but when you take a step back, it just kind of ends. All right, there we are, and we're just gonna move on and not really worry too much about it. I mean, I did like the nuclear weapons allegory that was going on here, but I don't know. I felt like it was delivered in such kind of a ho-hum way that you could just kind of gloss over it and it not really matter all that much. But it still wasn't like bad comics by any means. It just wasn't that great.
Gotcha. Yeah, I think you and I and Todd are kind of on the same page there.
You guys just don't like anything.
Love that. Love that response from Tim. Moving on to something I did like, actually, much to my own surprise. Captain America.
That popped, Todd.
Captain America 130 through 132. Cap on campus here a little bit, as well as the supposed return of Bucky Barnes. This is Captain America's opportunity to kind of delve into the political realm. Stan trying to make some statements through Cap here as he makes a visit to a college campus and finds protests and a dean that has no interest in listening to their students. Cap is attempted to be used for political means by a mysterious figure known as the Hood, who it winds up trying to manipulate Captain America by bringing back Bucky Barnes, or a fake Bucky Barnes, and then it's revealed that he was being manipulated the entire time by MODOK. So there's lots of manipulations of manipulations here in this story, but ultimately, especially for the political content in the beginning, I liked this Captain America story. I thought it was pretty well done, pretty good example of how the character of Captain America doesn't always have to be vehemently pro America. You know, he can kind of doesn't have to be pro establishment. He can kind of toe that line very delicately, and that's an important thing to remember, especially in today's day and age of increased division in our country. So yeah, I enjoyed this. Tim, I'll turn it over to you again because I know you are our Captain America correspondent after all.
Sure. Yes. Steve Rogers is, on the face of it, a pretty risky protagonist, right? Because he sort of has the Superman problem. He's such a perfect do-gooder, and on just that initial surface reading, you don't find much of interest just character-wise. But you get a story like this that tries to unpack and just examine what he does when he's off-duty and his observations and opinions about the world that he lives in now. You've really got something. And I think, once again, that speaks to what a stroke of genius it was on Stan Lee and Jack Kirby's parts to bring him back into the present day as just this man out of time, you know, 20-some-odd years removed from his canonical last appearance in World War II. There's just that is so rife with potential here. And I think that this story and this era of Cap, you can sort of feel the Easy Rider influence as well. I mean, it's number one, it's a guy on a motorcycle called Captain America, literally. But I mean, just that visual aesthetic as well, which is helped by Gene Colan's art, which, while I don't think this is the best Colan work that we've seen, I sort of dig the idea of him illustrating Captain America. I think the moodiness that he brings to the table really works here and well serves this version of the character. And, you know, it's just a story that's kind of heavy on themes of disenchantment and wanderlust, and just really worked for me, this 1970s slice of life, day in the life of Captain America. I like that Cap on Campus issue quite a lot. You get to see a somewhat snarky side to Captain America too, just in his dialogue, almost becoming like this cynical realist. He has his ideals, but he's just too much of a questioner, too much of a critical thinker to get played by anybody. I mean, he's essentially handed this script to recite on television that he very quickly flips on the fly because he knows what's up. He does not have to be smartened up by this point. So good stuff here all around. As far as some of the other plot machinations, I mean, yeah, you get that Hood reveal, that's Baron Strucker, kind of works, I guess, but then the double reveal of MODOK being behind it, just sort of because of a prank he wanted to play, I guess, for his own amusement, and getting Dr. Doom into the mix because he thinks he can't build a robot, it appeals to Doom's vanity and just all this stuff. I don't know. It felt like another writer coming in to retcon the story that had come before, except it's still Stan Lee. So it's just kind of wonky the way that plays out. But I enjoyed this a lot for what it was, and kind of looking forward to reading more of this type of Captain America, even though we're in the sort of waning days of Stan Lee's regular contributions as a writer.
Absolutely. Todd, your thoughts here on Captain America, these three issues we read.
Yeah, very goofy fun. Right from the get-go, where we have a faux Captain America movie, or at least, I don't know if they made it with found footage or they cast actors to have Captain America battling the Hulk, and Captain America is watching himself on the screen, or at least watching an actor as himself at the screen. So that's kind of a swerve they throw at us right away. The Captain America as a cynic works for me quite a bit here. The status quo has never been is not sacred and never will be, or never should have been. I like that line quite a bit. Cap in the middle of this student protest that was, we find out, had been engineered by the Hood / Baron Strucker, who is explicitly called a Nazi throughout, which is great. And then the MODOK reveal. I mean, it felt a little bit like the DC Challenge, which was an old comic that you would wrap it up and then the next creative team would try to pick up the pieces and retcon it. So this comic seemed like it was retconned right in the middle.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, it's the same writer, the same creative team. Yeah,
exactly. I don't know if Stan was just having fun with himself or bored or what, but it doesn't feel like the same Stan Lee throughout, which is very interesting. And the Bucky Bot, again, first of many times. It's not even the first, because we had Rick Jones as faux Bucky. And, you know, we go to that well for years and years until they actually go to that well, or they actually resurrect him in a great way, in a way that actually worked and that's still viable in the comics today. But all these sleazy people popping up in these stories, you know, these sleazy Hollywood manager types, we've seen that a couple times now. We saw it with Rick Jones, we saw it with Captain America, and then he gets the opportunity to get on TV and say things, and he's swerves them, you know, he's no puppet. And enjoyed it quite a bit, and it's interesting they went to San Francisco, which was You know, you don't usually think of Marvel Comics happening in San Francisco, so I like that quite a bit. The Bucky, you wouldn't necessarily have thought him as a robot at first, but I guess the reveal eventually makes sense. But then they bring Dr. Doom into it too, just to up the craziness. Yeah, just three issues of wacky fun, great action though, and enjoyed Colin art quite a bit. This is good Gene Colin, well inked by Dick Ayers, and I have read worse Captain America than this. That's definitely for sure, and I do like that MODOK ends up being the big bad. And then where does it leave us, you know, at the end? What do we... Mm-hmm. Cap is very sad about Bucky, and he reflects on, well, maybe it was such a good Bucky clone or Bucky robot that he was sentient, and Bucky's optimism shone through, you know? I don't know. I don't know how that works for me as well, but, you know, it's a tragic enough story to see Cap, you know, have what he wants, and then it's taken away again. And then he's back on the road on his motorcycle. So we'll see what happens with Captain America in 1971.
Awesome. Russell, your thoughts here on this three-part Captain America story?
Two steps forward, one step back. Those first two issues were excellent. I was all in on this mystery. The Baron Von Strucker reveal actually really worked for me. I loved that this wasn't just going to be, you know, some generic villain that, you know, we've never seen before and would probably never see again. It turns out to be a classic Captain America villain who appears to be manipulating Cap, you know, using this this new Bucky. Like, who is this Bucky? Is he legit? The real deal? Is this, could that actually be happening? I mean, it's honestly a pretty good mystery there to begin with. It really hooked me, and the Gene Colan art, as Todd pointed out, was pretty right on. This is some of the best work I've seen from him, and he tells a lot of story just through facial expressions, and he does it really well. So all of that was working big time for me. And then we got to issue 132, and the train completely derails. Once MODOK is revealed to have been manipulating the whole situation, I was already on shaky ground there, and I had already decided that this was not the ending I wanted for this story. But then it gets worse. They have the goodness of Bucky Barnes defeats his machine programming, and I just totally Seinfeld gift at that point. I threw my hands up like, you had it, Stan. You had it. You had this great story that was going right along. All of this was really awesome. And it's like, you know, to get a little topical here, it's like you did this amazing flip in the air and landed and broke both your legs at the same time. It just sucks. Like, it just really sucks that it wound up that way. So, you know, I hate it for him. I hate that that's the way this story ends. I really hate it for me because I was enjoying this story so much, but yeah, couldn't stick the landing. So that's where we are with that one. But otherwise it was like two parts of a great story and a third act that's just like basically shits the bed.
Absolutely. You know, well, I think we all had varying opinions on the last issue, but good to hear the other side of it. Moving on to Avengers 83. This is the final entry on our reading list for the part two of 1970, and it featured the kind of debut of Valkyrie, but not really Valkyrie by the end, and the introduction of the Lady Liberators, where they pulled together the Black Widow, the Scarlet Witch, the Wasp. Did I miss anybody? I'm sure there was somebody else in there. Somebody, help me out. Is that it?
Medusa.
Medusa was the other one. Thank you, Tim.
Deuce.
To rail against male-dominated society and how they've been held down, and they're going to go off and prove their worth. And eventually they go off and have a conflict with the Avengers at the Rutland Halloween Parade, which, of course, is a staple of 1970s comic storytelling, not just at Marvel, but also at the Distinguished Competition. I'm sure Tim and Todd can weigh in a little bit more on that one. Yeah, I didn't really like this, guys. This plot didn't do anything for me. It was going all these different directions at one time. It had to fit in the Lady Liberator plot. It had to fit in the actual Avengers. And it had to fit in the Rutland Halloween Parade, which I get it. Rogue crossovers, you know, big, you know, it was endlessly entertaining to the writers at the time. Not so much to readers a few decades later. So there you go. Todd, tell us about this Rutland Parade.
Rutland in Vermont is a city that apparently has a superhero parade that they are allowed to talk about in the comics, most famously in the DC Batman issue called Night of the Reaper. Sometimes you will see tributes to the other company in the Rutland parade depicted in, say you were reading Marvel, you would see maybe some DC characters. I don't see any here. Oh, yes, I do. I see a Batman. There he is. So that's kind of what the gimmick has always been to me, is that it's an excuse for them to draw DC characters in their book and vice versa. Here it's also an excuse to have Roy Thomas and his wife in there, and it's really cringeworthy, like extraordinarily cringeworthy. So that's the deal with Rutland. It's this 11th annual thing. It'd been going on since, say, the time pre Silver Age of comics, I suppose. Not much for me to say, well, that was a great thing. It's just kind of tiresome. It's like, oh, here we go yet again. Here's our we're so cute, we're going to draw our friends in the comics. So this comic book was not great, but I did appreciate the return to visual form by John Buscema with Tom Palmer inks. That looked good. And what a swerve with Valkyrie, especially knowing what we know now. I've expected to read this comic and learn about the Valkyrie that we have read about in comics like the Defenders and Thor, and that's not the case. So this is Valkyrie before there was Valkyrie, which ultimately doesn't make any sense, but it's kind of it's kind of like bringing back Jason Todd, and then, oh, he wasn't really back. Oh yes, actually he is back. Sorry,
we are carrying sorry, Russell. Shade over from podcast recording to podcast recording this week.
Man, Russell, I got really dark.
Shade
in here
was
all
thrown your direction, so the ball has been passed your way. Tell us about Avengers 83 and offer a retort to Todd if you feel the need.
Well, I'm going to do something out of character for myself and turn on the light to get rid of some of that shade. Because we all know that story was really great and Todd's just bitter. But that's neither here nor there.
What a shock. Hush was the guy they introduced in issue one all along.
He's so mad. But I digress. You see, the thing is, Todd is actually really right about this particular issue, as it weren't good. There weren't nothing in this that was really even worth reading, because you get to, I guess, the Valkyrie thing, but as Todd said, it's not even really Valkyrie. It's a fake out, and a bad one at that. I don't really get I get the Halloween parade now that it's been explained why this was a thing at all, but man, that's dumb. it's the whole thing is just real dumb, because here's this random little town in, well, what is it? It's Rutland, Vermont, a town I have never heard of, and this group of supervillains is going to show up here to take on this, what I would describe as the Avengers, at this time, the Avengers B team. Not really feeling this one. Didn't think that it really had much to offer. John Buscema art, proving once again that Sal was the superior artist. The idea of all the, you know, female heroes getting together to form their own team, I was actually pretty on board with that. I thought this, you know, had potential to be a really good idea, and maybe if You know, they had found out, you know, hey, Valkyrie is evil, but or turns out not to be Valkyrie at all. Why don't we just defeat her? But then we keep our, you know, our team going anyway. But that, I'm not really sure that they're really saying that's going to happen, or if they're just kind of like teasing it a little bit there at the end. This one's just kind of a mess. It's not really all that much fun. Action scenes feel just a little too wonky and just, you know, just not all that entertaining to me in any form or fashion. So, if it weren't for Captain Marvel, this would be the worst thing we read. But Captain Marvel keeping Avengers from being the bottom of the barrel. So there you go. That's the feather in your cap, Avengers. At least you ain't Captain Marvel.
Well said, sir. Tim, tell us about your thoughts here on Avengers 83.
Okay.
Here we go.
We don't. Not really. I would just add that there is an actual story here, but Roy Thomas just can't seem to chill with the self-indulgence to tell it, you know? This Rutland Halloween parade, okay, yeah, it's cute, it's mildly amusing, but it's also threatening to go really, really far up its own ass.
Yep.
Threatening, or is shouting at us from there, from inside its own ass?
Yeah, yeah, it very much
sure it reached the back of its teeth.
I don't know. I just feel like this is going to get worse.
Yes, it is.
You ain't seen nothing.
This is the first one, right?
Yeah, this is just the first time it's happened. And I mean, it just feels like a comic being written for five people. It's like, knock it off.
It's the comic book version of Hard Traveling Fanboys, is what you're saying.
I was about to say, I wasn't going to go there, but. Feels like,
hey,
some of the
we have often said that Hard Traveling Fanboys is produced for an audience of two, so
yes, perhaps resemble some of the more esoteric editions of HTF. But this Tom Fagan guy who's dressed as Nighthawk here, he is a real person. He's the guy who organized this parade for many, many years. He's dressed as Batman in the DC installments of this event, so they kind of continue that visual motif. But yeah, I mean, this is just notable for being the setting of many unofficial intercompany crossovers, where it's not so much the characters themselves appearing and interacting, but just kind of events on the periphery playing out in comics published by both Marvel and DC. So it will be one to watch throughout the 70s. It's just one of those goofy 70s things. And I do kind of feel like that's going to be the story of this decade in a nutshell. This comic might be almost a microcosm of what we're going to encounter here for the better part of 1970s Marvel. For better or worse.
And I trust that despite our bagging on the quality of this, that we will see future installments of the Rutland Halloween Parade covered here on the Marvel Age podcast.
Oh, absolutely.
Outstanding. I both can and can't wait.
I'm so tempted to include the DC issues.
We cannot go that far, sadly, but
they are not available on Marvel.
The DC issues of the Rutland Halloween Parade crossovers are not available on Marvel Unlimited, but they should be.
We will rage at Ben Morse.
In any event, does anybody else have any other thoughts, closing thoughts on Avengers 83?
What a jerk Clint Barton is.
In that last panel, yes.
Yeah. You finally learned your lesson about that women's lib. Bull.
Oh. Gotta love Douchebag Hawkeye. Well, that brings us to the end of our reading list, and it also brings us to the end of 1970. Because, of course, our last episode covered part one of 1970, so we're going to do as we do for every year and end with some year-end awards. And I would remind my colleagues once again not to fall victim to the recency bias they often do. So we'll kick it off. Where do you guys want to start? I think, how about Todd's favorite category, cover of the year? Oh, I think that's a good one to start with. And I will give you a moment to stall because I've already got mine picked out.
I have mine picked out.
Scrolling through our gallery of covers, I'm going to go Amazing Spider-Man number
87.
Number in the upper right hand quarter. 87. Yes.
Yep.
87. Amazing Spider-Man 87. This is kind of, it's a type of cover that is never done today anymore, but is kind of something that like just evokes this era of comics to me. Because you've got this image of Spider-Man in this huge profile looking down on all the supporting characters and even looking down on Peter Parker as they all like aghast at Peter Parker, and he's saying, that he is essentially telling them, confessing to them that he is Spider-Man. They look shocked, and it's got text all over it. It's something that I would hate probably if any comic did it today, and yet I love it here. It's an outstanding cover. Todd, who did the cover to this one? I'm trying to find that on Marvel Unlimited, but sometimes it has that information and sometimes it does not.
John Romita Sr.
There you go. Even though it says John Romita Jr. on Marvel Unlimited.
Yeah.
If you click on the tab, the creators, it says John Romita Jr. So, but yeah, John Romita cover. I freaking love it. Todd, is that the same way you're going?
150%. Wait, that's not a thing. Yes, all the way. This is my cover of the year. There were some other good ones. X-Men come to mind, but this is the one I think stands the test of time for 1970.
Yeah, there was a good Thor cover as well with Surtur on the front, but this was my pick as well. Russell, what about your cover of the year?
Amazing Spider-Man 87 is going to win. I've got a feeling it may be a clean sweep, but there is one other cover that really worked for me, and I don't think it's going to get called out by anybody else now. Thor 177. I really dig this cover. It's a good action shot of Thor. Hammer like raised back. The whole like for Asgard chant or like the call to action as he's going into battle. It's the issue after the one that has a Surtur on the front cover. Really good dynamic art there, but yeah, there's really nothing like this Amazing Spider-Man 87 cover in all of the others that we're reading. Very rarely do you see something like this done today, and I'm with you, Nick. I typically really hate dialogue covers. I hate text on covers because I feel like it's taking away from the presentation. You should be able to like tease me with the art. Don't tell me every little thing about what's going on inside the issue. It works better for this era, certainly, and it works really well for this cover. So, I think Amazing Spider-Man 87 is your best cover.
Tim?
It's not quite a clean sweep because while I will not choose that particular issue, I will choose a different issue of ASM, that being issue 90. Take another look at that, where you've got... It's proclaiming Spider-Man killer, right? And he's carrying this body. So right away, that piques your curiosity, where you're wondering, okay, is this someone who's really dead? And clearly, Spider-Man cannot be responsible. But when you read the issue for what it is, you know that in a way, in a sense, yes, he is responsible for this death. And it takes care to keep this person's identity, their head in silhouette, so you don't know who it is. It doesn't give away that very monumental reveal. So I think it's a great cover that doesn't necessarily speak to how monumental an issue this really is, but still functions very well in its own right. So that's why I think I'm going to give it to that. And it's just sort of different from what the kinds of covers we're used to seeing. It kind of just struck me as soon as I know you mentioned recency bias, but as soon as I laid eyes on it, I just found it very, very striking.
Absolutely. Let's move on to our villain of the year, and we'll start with the guy who just we just left off with. Tim, tell us your villain of 1970.
Who was my villain? Well, I can't name Rick Jones, probably.
Sadly.
I feel like I've got to give it up for Loki. who I wasn't sure would be making another appearance in this category on this podcast, especially, you know, not so soon. After
yeah, he'll probably get back on there by the time we reach the Simonson days, but we're many episodes away from that.
Right, right. And that, of course, is owing to that Thor three-parter, 175 through 177, where he claimed the throne of Asgard in resplendent fashion. That great wardrobe change that he makes yes. in so doing is very impressive. And just good, conniving, cunning Loki stuff. Really enjoyed that.
Awesome. Well, I'll kind of piggyback off of that because I considered Loki, but ultimately I came to a realization when thinking about this category, and the realization was this. Pretty much any time this character pops up on our reading list, he's going to be my villain of the year, and that, of course, is the Fire Demon Surtur. It's okay. My favorite villainous concept in Thor, even above Loki. It is an indicator, typically, of stakes and emotion, unless you're making a movie, of course. And it is just an outstanding visual for a Thor villain. Yep. I mean, it is what it is. So I'm going to go Surtur as my villain of the year. Russell, your villain of 1970.
I appreciate Tim. I appreciate both of your picks. Tim, found that Loki's level of extra was great and spoke to me in a way that I enjoyed.
I think there's one panel in there where he's talking to somebody and he says something, and you can almost see his face, like the way Kirby draws it. His face is twisted up like the Grinch.
Yes.
And, like, it is wonderful.
It is great. Surtur, just as a force of nature, that's like just an evil entity. I absolutely loved him too. But I'm going Kingpin this year. Because I really enjoyed the amount of depth that his character was given in the issues of Amazing Spider-Man we read back in part one. Kingpin has a family. Kingpin has, you know, a lot more going on than just, you know, his villainous empire or his, not his empire, but yeah, his business dealings, as it were. He has, you know, more vulnerability than I think we've ever seen him have. It humanized him in a way, but it also flips things back around to show that at his core, he's still a pretty terrible person. He's still just an awful, awful human being. And I can really appreciate a story that gives you that kind of swerve. So Kingpin kind of wins that one for me, but I will say this. This was pretty weak in terms of a year of villains. They didn't really make as much impact as they had before because it feels more to me like the real starring villain in all of these issues, kind of as a through line, is society and circumstances within that winds up being more of a driving force.
Interesting. Yeah, I got to say, if it weren't for that Thor three-parter, I probably would have gone Kingpin as well. So he was probably my favorite non-Thor villain of 1970. Todd, your villain of the year.
I went Kingpin as well, specifically for the development we got with him and just how he was the chaotic force that kind of propelled all the events of the Spider-Man losing his memory or being exposed to his secret identity in that storyline. So that's what I picked. Honorable mention to MODOK. No, just kidding.
I will say I considered Kingpin, but really he wins the Linda McMahon Memorial Award for this year. That's what I would give him.
But she's not dead.
Neither is Peter David.
Thread
has never stopped us from saying these terrible things.
Moving on to our hero of the year, Todd, we'll go back to you. Your hero of 1970.
I was tempted to go with Thor, but it's got to be Spider-Man. Come on, man. Spider-Man, yep. this is just, he's head and shoulders above the most interesting character. Although Captain America had a nice little strong run here.
He did.
But to me, I would be buying Spider-Man every month, no matter what, if I was a comics buyer in 1970.
Yeah, I'm going to go with you on this one as well. There was a part of me that was tempted to give it to Thor, but there was more Spider-Man than any other character on each of our reading lists, and I think that's because he's quickly become the most interesting character in Marvel's publishing pantheon. He's got more going on for him. He's got more of a fully developed supporting cast. He's got all these different angles. You can tell just about any kind of story with him at any given point, and that bears that out here in 1970. So, yeah, I'm going to go Peter Parker, Spider-Man, as my hero of the year. Russell, your choice.
Let's keep it going. Spider-Man is a pretty clear winner across board, just because his stories were better. The developments with him as a hero were just the strongest of everyone out there. As Todd already said, if I were buying comics in this era, Amazing Spider-Man would have to be like number one, like top of the pile list every single month. So it's a pretty easy pick for me on this one.
Tim, your selection?
Very, very, very honorable mention to Captain America. I do think if we had read more of 1970 Cap comics, you could maybe make a case for him, but as it stands, yeah, you gotta go Spider-Man.
Awesome. Good choice there. Let's move on to let's do Artist of the Year first, and I will start here and say that for me, we kind of get a smorgasbord, a little snapshot of various artists across the Marvel pantheon at this point, but Jack Kirby is still drawing Thor, guys, and for that outstanding Fall of Asgard story, I'm going to go to the king for probably the final time in this show's history. So Jack Kirby is my Artist of the Year for 1970. Tim?
Wow. This is a tough one. I'm already kicking myself for not including like the final Kirby Thor issues, just for the sake of saying this is the end of Kirby Thor. Because mm-hmm. He does stick around for a little bit after that Fall of Asgard story. Mm-hmm. But just almost for no other reason than I doubt we will ever give it to him again, sadly, on this show. I'm going to go with Kirby as well. He wasn't up against super stiff competition. I think you could make a case for maybe one other, but I'm going to go with Kirby too.
Awesome. Russell?
I am also going to have to go Jack Kirby. He was the most consistent artist in all of the books that we read. This is also his swan song, and as Nick already said, this is probably going to be the last time that that we talk about him in that capacity on this podcast, because this was the end of his Fantastic Four run. It was a great run. His stuff on Thor, though, is where it's really at. That's the best looking art of all these books, I think. Well, that's going a little bit far. If Gil Kane had drawn every issue of Amazing Spider-Man that we read, he would win it in a walk for me. It would not even be close. But Jack Kirby had far more consistency, had a lot more output, and he was still keeping up that pace and the classic look on Fantastic Four and on Thor. So I think you kind of have to give it to Kirby just for sheer output and quality all in one. So the king still reigns.
Todd, are you going to make it a clean sweep or go somewhere else?
Were I reading a comic by just following the panels and not reading the dialogue, I would say that Kirby's work on the Fall of Asgard, just for that fact alone, the storytelling alone, would earn him this award this time around. Just going to be really sad not to see any Kirby on this list for a long time. And it is a clean sweep. He is the choice. I enjoyed a lot of the art. I like the one Neil Adams issue we had. The liked some of the Herb Trimpe stuff, to be honest, that I saw in Hulk.
Yeah.
And, Romita's solid, the Kane on Spider-Man especially is pretty good. Credit to Romita there, in my opinion. But, you know, I'm going to give it to Kirby as a last hurrah, but he earned it. Yeah. Those comics and the covers were really good.
And it's of course sad to report that we are about to enter an undoubted dark period in the Thor publishing line, because post Kirby is a bit of a rough stretch, but we will take that medicine as we must. Cross that bridge when we get there, if you will. Moving on to Writer of the Year, and I'll go first again here. You know, we start to see more and more writers in 1970 kind of getting a crack at it, but all the best stuff is still written by Stan. Thor is written by Stan. Spider-Man's written by Stan. That Captain America stuff we praised was written by Stan. So for me, Stan Lee kind of takes it in a walk, honestly. So I'm going to go Stan. Todd, your selection for Writer of the Year.
Yeah, you said it perfect, Bubba. It's Stan.
Great. Russell?
It's got to be Stan Lee. There is no other real choice.
Gotcha. And Tim?
Stan the motherfucking man. It is hard to believe that he is still improving so very much as a writer when he already had such a high ceiling. It just is so bittersweet to think that we're really only going to get another year of somewhat regular Stan Lee written comics, and he's just going out on such a high note and so unexpectedly to me. I want more of this Stan Lee.
Absolutely. It was outstanding. And then finally, our story of the year for me, this is no surprise to anyone who knows my taste in comics. It's Thor 175 through 177, The Fall of Asgard. You've got all the best things in Thor. You've got, you know, sanctimonious, shit-eating Gren Loki. You've got Surtur popping up to wreck shop. You've got Kirby doing all these outstanding visuals. You've got Stan kind of at his Shakespearean best. It is a landmark in the Thor publishing history. So for me, Thor 175 to 177, Fall of Asgard takes it for me. Tim, your story of the year.
ASM 88 through 90, that Doc Ock saga. Mm-hmm. It's hard to find a bad Spider-Man comic anyway. The bar is set extraordinarily high on the series as a rule, and that one really cleared it. I love that story, I'm just so grateful that it lived up to its sterling reputation.
Outstanding. Russell, your story of the year.
I'm going to go Amazing Spider-Man 88 through 91. All of that stuff, beginning to end, it all flows as like one big story, and it is so well done. Everything about it is just tremendous. The Fall of Asgard stuff, real close second place, but no, that from the writing, the pacing, just the you know, emotional weight of everything that happens in that story, and the just jaw-dropping level of Gil Kane art with the, of course, the big assist from John Romita Sr. Tremendous. Can't say enough good about it. That story of the year.
Absolutely. Todd, your story of the year.
Doc Ock's disembodied arms leading through to the death and kind of the usurping of Captain Stacy's power by Sam Bullitt. It's Amazing Spider-Man 88 through 91. I'll say it's the death of Captain Stacy saga. How about that?
Yeah. Yep.
So that's my choice. It's absolutely. I'm glad I read it.
Great choices by you guys. Well, that brings us to an end for this episode of the Marvel Age podcast, and brings to an end our journey through 1970. When next we join you, we will be taking a look at part one of 1971. And just as a sort of a PSA, 1971 marks our transition from two-part episodes into three-part episodes. We are breaking that barrier. We are popping that cherry here on the Marvel Age podcast next time out. So just so you're aware, you can always find that reading list at the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. It's actually pinned to the top there. But just in case you're not able to look at it, next time out we're going to cover Fantastic Four 105 to 106, Amazing Spider-Man 92, Captain America 133, Avengers 85 to 86, The Submariner 34 to 35, Fantastic Four 107 to 110, Avengers 88, Incredible Hulk 140, and Savage Tales featuring some Man-Thing.
We're going to see if we can cover that one because it's not on Marvel Unlimited. So
is it really not? Oh man,
I can't find it anywhere, and I was actually hoping that, given that it is the first appearance of the Man-Thing, who's not an A-list character but somewhat prominent, that maybe it'd be reprinted somewhere that is on MU. Not that I could find. So,
well, we'll have to discuss that.
We'll put an asterisk next to that one.
Absolutely. But before we head out, we'll close the show as we always do by giving everybody an opportunity to plug their shit. I, of course, can be found on Twitter at NickDuke87, and you can find me on the Place to Be Nation Pop airwaves with my cohort Greg Phillips over on the Hard Traveling Fanboys podcast. We are, by the time you hear this, we are getting near the end of Shazam month, and we're barreling towards Avengers month, in celebration of Avengers Endgame coming up. So lots of good stuff you can hear there. I don't think I have anything else going on right now. Occasionally I have some what-if wrestling that drops over on the wrestling feed, but none of that to speak of at the moment. So, Tim, tell people where they can find you and what you got going on.
You can find me on Twitter at Cyke68. That is Cyke68. I've had a busy month podcast-wise, surprisingly to me, in ways that I did not realize. So you heard about the shows on the Place Me Nation feed and Place Me Nation Wrestling that I have appeared on thus far. Coming up, you can look for me on an episode of Laugh In Theater with Andy Atherton, and something else on the wrestling feed, Talking WCW. We have not scheduled it just yet, but we will be dropping an episode of Talking WCW later this month. Myself, Jennifer Smith, and your dear, close, personal, longtime friend, Nick Duke, that is Greg Phillips. Mm-hmm. So that show is so much fun to do, Talking WCW. I love it a lot.
Glad to
hear it. Almost as much as I love the Marvel Age podcast.
Oh. Your ass-kissing is working, sir. Russell, tell people where they can find you and what you got going on.
You can hit me on Twitter and Instagram at Russell_Sellers. We already plugged most of my shit earlier in the show. There is a new episode of DC Post-Crisis Management in the can, and is going to be on its way to the people pretty soon, as well as another episode of that, which will actually close out that series. So the next episode that's coming up is the penultimate episode of DCPCM. Mm. And there is another project already in the works that has already had a lot of work done on it. But we will, I guess, make the big official announcement about that on the final episode of DC Post-Crisis Management. That'll be coming up in May. So other than that, just keep a lookout for all the wonderful shows that I'm on. And I'm sure that I will be doing Marvel Age Masterclass with Ben Morris for 1970 Part 2 in the coming weeks.
Gotcha. Todd, plug your shit. Tell people where they can find you.
Well, sure. Guitars of Green on Instagram, at Todd Weber Guitar on Twitter, and this is something I don't always do, but you should check out my bands on Facebook. Those mm-hmm. bands are Sea Legs, Turnbuckle Blues Review, Petty Party, and The Stummies. And I'd like to leave you guys with a little number from the last Stummies record. It's called Wake Up Dead. One of these mornings you may wake up dead. Find nothing but shadows living in your head. So, anyway, take us home, Nick.
Awesome. Well, guys, dear listeners, thank you for joining us once more on this year-by-year journey through the Marvel publishing history. We will see you for 1971. Enough said.